Well, it's good to be with you this evening and to have the Bible read so beautifully. Wow, that was very well read. Thank you. If you're a Christian here this evening, which I'm guessing most of you are, the truth of the Bible ought to matter to you immensely. It's so important to our faith. We are not saved, that is, we're not going to heaven because of what Jesus said. We're going because of what Jesus did. Christians believe in historical events. They're important to us. And the cross hanging from your church ceiling behind me is a very vivid visual reminder that we believe in something that happened 2,000 years ago, and we're pinning our whole destiny onto these events. So it ought to be very important to us that we know the truth of these events. And as David had mentioned in his introduction, that what we have in our hands is trustworthy, it's real. It hasn't changed, it hasn't been distorted, embellished in any way. If these events didn't really happen in these ways, Paul in that passage would go on to say, well, we may as well throw in our faith. If Jesus really didn't die and rise from the dead, let's all just go home. But we do believe in a God who avatared himself 2,000 years ago and taught incredible things, did amazing, jaw-dropping, eye-popping, nature-bending miracles, died for us, absorbing in his own body the wrath we all deserve, and rose again 3 days later and ascended into heaven. I'm rolling my whole destiny onto that. If it's not true, even if it's only half true, then I should walk away. It's got to be all true. And so the truth of the Bible is very important to us. And that's why I think it matters, and a talk like this. I'm just defending my talk, really. I'm fascinated that one of our early creeds in Christendom, the Apostles' Creed, which we say at our church from time to time, and I'm sure you do here, being good Anglicans, the Apostles' Creed, which sort of condenses the essence of Christian faith, has in it a Roman governor. It's a great reminder that our faith is historical. It's based on events that happened in the Greco-Roman world 2,000 years ago. And as David mentioned, who kind of half stole my introduction, it's not only important to us for our own personal reasons, it's also important for our own evangelism, i.e. helping other people come to faith. Peter said this, "Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you, to give the reason for the hope that you have, but do this with gentleness and respect." So lots of our friends will have questions. If we have a faith that's built on historical events, people will have historical questions. They want to ask you about, how do you know this is true? How do we know Jesus existed? What evidence do we have? How do we know the Bible hasn't changed or been distorted in any way over the years? Has there been some sort of great conspiracy theory, cover-up, that sort of thing? And it's not only good for you to be able to answer these things so that you have integrity in your faith, but it's good so that you can help others. I remember when I was first asked these historical questions, when I first became a Christian in my teens, I was embarrassed for my own self that I couldn't answer the questions, but I was actually sorry that I couldn't help my friends see the truth of what I believed in. And so I went away determined more than ever to kind of read up on all of this stuff. So we're commanded to know this stuff from the scriptures, as well as having this conviction for our own personal reasons. Now, I came here last year in 2017 and gave a talk on the historicity of the Bible. And I think once or twice in the talk, I just had a throwaway line where I just said, oh, I wish I could say more. I've got more on this stuff, but I've had to leave it on the editing room floor because we just don't have the time. Well, Rupert noted that comment and said, come back again, and that's why I'm back again. I said, oh, I can't remember what I said. And so I think it was Josh someone sent me the recording of that talk, and I listened to it again. And now I remember what I'd said. Now, I said to Rupert, how many of you heard that talk? Do you think we'll be here tonight and all that sort of stuff? And he said, there's been a bit of a change, a bit of a turnover. People come and go, and no one remembers my sermons from each week, so you should be fine. And I'm sure that's not the case. Anyway, I'm just going to take up on one thing I was talking about in the talk last year, and that is the transmission of the Bible. Not the translation, but the transmission, how it's transmitted through the ages to get from when it was first written to us today, and particularly concentrating on the New Testament document, the letters and the Gospels and the history of the early church and the book of Acts, the 27 books of the New Testament. So that's where I'm picking up from, okay? Is everyone on board? Everyone strapped in, ready? Okay, you all look mega excited, so that's great. So, as I was saying, the story sort of goes like this. I don't know how well you can see the visuals from where you are. If you're optically challenged at the back, I'm sorry. But Jesus preached, taught, did miracles, died, rose again in this period. This is the general consensus of when Jesus did these things, AD 28 to AD 30. And the witnesses of his sermons and miracles were the apostles, the 12 apostles and others, but the 12 apostles in particular. And then they passed it on to basically their disciples, the first generation of Christians to the second generation, if you like. And they make it into the Bible itself. We hear about them, Timothy, Mark, Silas, and so on. But the story goes, according to maybe Dan Brown or others, that the transferring of the information was slightly distorted. And then when they pass it on, someone else heard it and heard it in a slightly different way. And then that particular person might have read some other stuff and decided to incorporate maybe other myths and legends into the story. And then so when he told it and passed it on to his friends, they were getting another distorted version again. And then sometime later, and you know, some people might say, the New Testament was written down, say, in the next century, the second century. And from there, it was copied. And various people added their own little bits and changed and edited it the way they thought best. And through the Middle Ages, the church got a hold of it and really added their own things to really suppress people and so on, till the Bible we have today has been radically distorted. That's the kind of myth story that maybe many of us have heard or come across, or even still believe to some extent. So, going from basically here to here, the Bible we have in our hands is a far cry from the Jesus of history. That's the argument, in essence. And I actually want to say and challenge that view. It's called sometimes the Chinese whisper view, or I'm not sure what you call this game in the UK. In America, they call it the telephone game. Is it called Chinese whispers here? It's where one person comes up with a little story, a line, say, and they pass it on to the next person and the next person, and then so on and so forth. And you do this on camps, don't you? You sit in a circle and it's passed around the room until it gets finally to the last person, And they say something completely different to the very first person in the room. And so it's believed that the Bible has come to us like that, this kind of Chinese whispers or telephone game, changed and distorted, and it's a far cry from what was originally taught and what really happened. Let me just dismantle some of this straight away quite easily. Firstly, this game called Chinese whispers or telephone. What do you call it in the Chinese whispers? Oh, same as the Aussies, okay. Firstly, one of the rules in Chinese whispers is you're only allowed to whisper. The other rule in Chinese whispers is you're only allowed to say it once. In other words, the whole thing is designed to cause confusion so that when the person at the end does tell everyone in the group their version of the sentence or story or whatever, it's designed to create fun and laughter and be an icebreaker and so on. So sentences were deliberately also hard. So you'd give this sort of tongue twister that would deliberately cause confusion. And you're only allowed to hear from the previous person. You couldn't actually go back and ask someone further down the queue. You could only hear from the person next to you. So already the rules of Chinese whispers are a far cry, radically different to the way the Bible has come to us through the centuries. Well, let's look at the reality then, because it's not a Chinese whispers story at all. Now, first of all, what I want to do is just give you two terms so that we're clear on the terms. Firstly, the period between the events actually happening or being spoken and the time they were written down is called the sort of oral period, the oral transmission period, from when Jesus first gave this parable on the Good Samaritan to when it was finally written down in one of the Gospels, let's say. This is called the oral period. This is the period of oral transmission. There's a whole science that goes into understanding that, particularly within biblical circles. Then the period from the very first documents, the originals, the autographs, right through to our present day, our Bibles that we have in front of us on our laps, is the written transmission, the period of written transmission. Okay, so the oral tradition or transmission and the written tradition or transmission. All right, let's work backwards. The written transmission or tradition of the Bible. Okay, let's first of all get the dates right. The New Testament, all of it, wasn't written in the 2nd century or the 3rd century. It was all written in the 1st century. So this date that you sometimes see bantered around in books like perhaps Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code or whatever, is just completely untrue. The New Testament was written in a period from about, probably the earliest documents we have of the New Testament come from the late 40s, certainly the 50s of the first century. And then the last books of the New Testament, I actually personally believe, along with a good lot of very good scholars on this, believe the entire rest of the New Testament was written before AD 70. But I'll be flexible on it and we'll go up to AD 80. But that is a far more realistic time of when the New Testament was written in that period. And keep in mind that the earliest documents were written by the Apostle Paul. His letters, in fact, all 13 letters that you get in the New Testament were written almost certainly before the four Gospels. So our earliest documents on the Christian faith are from Paul written in perhaps the late 40s to the very early 60s of the first century. That means the gap between the actual events and the writing of them down is actually quite small. It's very impressive to historians. It's not many decades later, centuries later. It's a very, very small gap. The other thing to keep in mind is the scriptures didn't come from some person much further down the line. It's not like it was transferred from the apostles then to their disciples and then their disciples and then their neighbours and then their relatives and so on and so forth till it finally got to this guy who then decided, yep, I'm going to write it down. No. It actually looks like this. Jesus told the parables, gave his teachings, gave the Sermon on the Mount, did miracles, rose from the dead, died, rose from the dead, all in front of his apostles, who then passed it on to their disciples. And it's the apostles and their immediate disciples who give us the New Testament. It's not guys way further down the track. It's these people. So the gap is short, but the people telling us this stuff were the eyewitnesses or that second generation, like Mark, who wrote Mark's Gospel, but writing under Peter, or Luke, who interviewed a number of the apostles, hung out with the apostles, wrote under them, and so on. So this is very impressive indeed. I'm pretty sure I've got this right, but everything we know about Alexander the Great comes from people who never met him. But we're reading the very eyewitness accounts in most cases when it comes to the New Testament. So that's very impressive. We're going back to the original kind of people who were there at the time, not something ages later. Now, when we want to find out about the earliest writings that we have about Jesus and from the apostles and their understudies, we have lots of manuscripts that have come up through the ages, lots of copies of the originals. And that some of the manuscripts date from the Middle Ages. But the Bible that you have in your hand isn't a translation from the Middle Age documents, the Middle Age manuscripts. A manuscript, by the way, is something that has been manually scripted, in other words, handwritten. So when you hear about manuscripts, it could be from 10 years ago. But generally, manuscripts are sort of pre-1600s, certainly when you're talking about biblical manuscripts. Now, when the translators of your Bibles that you have in front of us, in front of you, the NIV, they don't go to the Middle Age manuscripts. This is almost irrelevant to us. They go back to the earliest documents, the earliest manuscripts we have. Getting back to the Chinese whispers theory, it's as if the person on the end who's just heard it from, you know, the second last person in the group, he can actually just go, oh, I'm going to make sure this is right, and just go back and ask people early on in the queue and hear it directly from them. So we go back to the earliest manuscripts we have to date to get the text that you have in front of you. It doesn't come from someone in the 19th century, the 18th century, or the 15th century, or the 14th, or the 13th. We're going back to the 2nd and 3rd century, 4th century. This is where our Bible translations come from. So the whole Chinese whispers thing can be thrown out the door. Now, how do you date these things? How do we know that this document comes from the 2nd or 3rd or 4th century? Scholars all around the world are doing this all the time to work out the dates of things. Whether it's the Hebrew scriptures or the Greek New Testament scriptures or translations in Latin and so on, there's a whole science to this dating manuscripts. Now, I reckon all of you in this room, just from a couple of hours of lectures, could begin to do this with documents over the last, 1,000 years. Just with a little bit of training, you could do it. You could pinpoint things, not just to what century it came from, but maybe which half of the century it came from. Think about, this is going to be easy for you, but think about the 20th century. And you take a newspaper from the 20th century. Now, if you could view this up close and without cheating and looking at the dates, I reckon some of you, with a good eye, could work it out when this newspaper clip comes from. And what you're doing in your mind right now is what the professionals do for ancient biblical manuscripts. One of the things you're probably looking at is the font. What kind of font? Because fonts change over the decades, don't they? Newspapers used slightly different fonts, different spacing. The column size is actually different. The content is different. The paper that it's written on is different. The material used is different. You can date newspaper clippings often with just a little bit of detective work and work out, okay, this comes from the 1920s, or this comes from the 1960s, or this is definitely 80s, the way they're speaking. You think of the language used in yesteryear, Here's an ad that I just downloaded. Celery Cola picks you up. We cordially, who uses that word anymore, invite you to visit our booth at the Indoor Circus Auto Show and Merchants Exposition, where you will find a complete display of our products. So even the language is slightly antiquated, isn't it? This stuff is going on all the time with New Testament manuscripts so that we can not only date the century it was written in, but perhaps even the decade it was written in. And not only that, you can date not only when it was written, but how it's a copy of something earlier. So you date the material, the hand of the scribe, to maybe 3rd century. But the way it's written, the language used, the names used even, is far more 1st century than it is 2nd or 3rd century. There's a whole science to this. And furthermore, when some manuscripts are found in situ, that is within, say, a cave or an excavated synagogue or something like that, we can date some of the manuscripts that are found alongside other items that are found in the same strata level. So the Dead Sea Scrolls, for instance, they are found, that when they were found in some of the caves, archaeologists discovered sandals and coins and jars and pots and cups and leather garments, leather bags and so on, that could all be dated in various ways, including DNA testing on the leather. So we can actually pinpoint that these manuscripts and the content that they're saying comes from this century or is a translation from a century before, and even possibly, in many cases, the decade. Plus, on top of that, with the biblical manuscripts, we've got other writings that help us understand when they were written. So from early Christian writings, we read about Mark and Peter. Mark became Peter's interpreter and wrote down accurately as much as he remembered of the things said and done by the Lord. For he had not heard the Lord, so he wasn't an eyewitness directly, Mark, but later followed Peter. So he met Peter, wrote with him, and hung out with him. So he followed Peter, who used to deliver the message, preach, with a view to particular needs. Mark gave attention to one thing, to leave out nothing of what he had heard and to make no false statements in them. Another early Christian writing says this of Mark. Mark, who was called stump-fingered because he had short fingers in comparison with the size of the rest of his body, he was, so we know his nickname now, he was Peter's interpreter. After the death of Peter himself, he wrote down the same gospel in the regions of Italy. So all these things go into giving us great confidence that the manuscripts that are used for our translation date from a very early period. So, it looks like this. That we go back to the first century when the originals were written. We don't have the originals, but we've got copies, and we're sure they're copies of the originals for a whole heap of reasons. Now, another thing about the Chinese whisper game is that it's completely and utterly linear. It just goes round the room or along the line just once in one direction. The New Testament manuscripts and their copies aren't just, it's not just like we had one copy of the Gospel of John, let's say, then with the original, and then one copy, and then that copy disappeared, and then we got one copy here, and one copy here, and that was it. It doesn't come. The copies were made in multiple ways, in multiple regions by different scribes. So the New Testament doesn't come to us just through one line, but many different lines. So it looks more like this. When the Bible was written, there were copies made, and then as those copies began to deteriorate, or just because they wanted to get the message out further, more and more copies were made, and copies of copies were made, and so on and so forth. Now, we don't have the original of any of the New Testament books, sadly, but that doesn't faze historians in this field whatsoever. We don't have the original of so much of the ancient world. So actually on the diagram, it looks a bit like this, actually. We don't have the original. You can see that disappearing of, let's say, the Gospel of John. And actually, sadly, due to wear and tear and loss and fires and wars and burials and so on, it looks more like this. But there are still hundreds of manuscripts that date before, say, the 5th century that we have at our fingertips to look at. You can see them online today. Some of the best ones, the earliest ones, exist in England. Some are across the creek in Dublin. And one of the earliest fragments of the Book of Acts is in Australia. They're all over the world. They're not just hidden. Does that surprise some of you? they're not all in a Vatican vault, all being manipulated where no one can see them. They're virtually all public. And what we can do is go back and compare and contrast them. So let's just take these four, for example. One, say, from the 2nd century and another from the 3rd and two from the 4th century, but come from different lines. So there is sometimes slight differences. A word is missing, or instead of saying Jesus Christ, it says Christ Jesus. Or sometimes the spelling of a name or a particular word is changed a bit. But they're virtually identical. And we're going back to the earliest copies. In fact, one of the earliest copies, in fact, if not the earliest copy, which exists in England, it's in Manchester in the John Rylands Library, is probably, or at least possibly, a second edition of John's Gospel. It's a fragment of a scroll that is possibly a second edition of John's Gospel. It dates to 125, AD 125. So the scribe of that could have had the original John's Gospel in front of him, or the group of scribes. or whatever. Again, it's like we can just go back and speak to the very people who are not the very first person, but at least the second, third, and fourth person in the Chinese Whispers game to clarify. And that's how our Bibles come to us in written form. But what about that oral period, that oral tradition period, when things were first said and done, and then three decades later, they were written down? Well, here's a couple of things to keep in mind. The Gospels, certainly, I would say, and most likely for the epistles, the letters in the New Testament, what we have in our Bibles now are the final edition. In other words, there was probably several drafts, before we get what we've got in our New Testament. In other words, when Paul was writing to the Corinthians, say, his letter 1 Corinthians that we've had read to us, almost certainly he wrote that over a long period of time and drafted it maybe 2 or 3 times with a scribe to help him. In other words, when it was written down was probably even earlier than the dates that we have in our Bibles about when they were written. There were probably earlier drafts. That's certainly the case, I think, for the Gospels. And this is something I remember showing you last time. But the apostles, at least one or two of them, and the other writers of the New Testament, often would write on things that looked like this. This is a wooden tablet that was usually covered in wax. And you can see the stylus, 2 stylus on the right, styli, I'm not sure what the plural is, on the right, with a pointy end for writing and a flat end for rubbing the wax. This, incidentally, is how our iPads and so on are called tablets. This is the original. And they would write in shorthand. So it is quite possible that the Sermon on the Mount, or the parables, or even some of the accounts of Jesus' miracles, were written in fairly brief shorthand, and then only later on were finally composed and edited together to give us Mark's Gospel, Luke's Gospel, Matthew's Gospel, John's Gospel. It is quite likely, I think, Matthew, being a tax collector, had one of these under his arm or in his backpack or something, and just sat on a rock just taking notes, knowing, I'm going to write this down, it's going to be a bestseller one day, and just going for it. The other really interesting thing, and this is something I'm studying quite a bit of late, I think this is very interesting, is in the Gospels in particular, but also in the writings of Paul, there's this science that the best in the know call performed material. You see that there's something about the writing that it sounds like it comes from someone else, not just the author who's writing it down. If I came here one evening and I gave my testimony, and then suddenly, halfway through the testimony, I said to you, I once was lost, but now I'm found. I was blind, but now I see. Almost all of you would recognize that's performed material. It doesn't come from me. It's not my original words. It comes from Amazing Grace, the hymn. We can detect this in the Gospels. Do you notice how often in the Gospels that I got it here. Here. The miracles are just so short. They're not long. They're usually about 7 verses. And they're also formulaic. There's a kind of crowd-setting scene. The person's problem is flagged up. People's doubts are then talked about. Jesus does the miracle against everyone's doubts, and then everyone goes home amazed, or something happens. There's a conclusion at the end, like the Pharisees then plot to kill Jesus, or everyone went amazed, or the man went out and told everyone that he'd been healed, or something like that. This is a classic example. And there's repeated words in the story so that you could tell that people in the oral period could memorize them really easily. They weren't long-winded, really complicated. They're really simple. So when you get to Mark's gospel, which is probably the first gospel written, you're actually, what you're reading is not Mark sitting down going, oh, I'm just going to write the story of Jesus. He's just simply sewing together stuff that's probably already written down or that he'd heard again and again from Peter in very memorable bite-sized chunks. And he's just being the editor. Just adding, after this, Jesus went here, and this is what happened. Bang. This is performed material. And you get it also in the passage that was read to us. In fact, directly, when Paul says in this chapter 15 of 1 Corinthians, in verse 3 he says, "For what I received, I've passed on to you." And then he basically gives a rehearsed creed, if you like, almost, that Christ died for sins according to the scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, that is Peter, and to the 12, and so on. It reads like a rehearsed creed that has come in a very memorable form. You get another one in Colossians chapter 1, verses 15 to 20. In Philippians chapter 2, and so on. So what we're getting is not just the disciples sitting down, the apostles sitting down decades later and going, oh, how did, what happened again? Oh, yeah, let's just, oh, yeah, what do you remember? It's stuff that has come down well-rehearsed, well-memorized, perhaps written, and they're just piecing it all together. And furthermore, the art of memory for Jews in the first century was just so common. Like, we don't have to memorize things anymore because we just write it down in our phones or on a notepad, or we can look it up on Google or whatever. A very interesting book, as I come to a close, is this book. Probably the best in its field, Memory and Manuscript. By Berger Gerhardsen. This is a whole level of study that really is the top of his game. If you want a book on this kind of stuff, get this one. He talks about how Jews in their culture just practice the art of memorizing and dare not change anything that they heard in their day. So there was a rule in rabbinic circles that one should always study things very, very carefully and then meditate on it afterwards. So you memorized it word for word. There are Jews to this day that can quote the entire Pentateuch from memory, or at least whole books, like the whole book of Deuteronomy, from memory. There's schools of this discipline even in Judaism today. Rabbinical teaching was that a man's duty is to repeat a passage to his pupil four times before he passes on. So it's not like the Chinese whisper thing at all. In fact, in some circles, there was this little saying, the man who repeats his chapter 100 times is not to be compared with the man who repeats it 101 times. The pupil is thus duty-bound to maintain his teacher's exact words. It was common practice that you went away and you told exactly what your teacher said. You didn't do it in your own words. So here's one of his conclusions in the book. The art of reproducing another person's statements in one's own words and of abstracting the points of view and ideas from someone's words has been carried to considerable lengths in the Hellenized West, that is, the Greco kind of Roman Greece and Rome, Italy. It was practice that you did sort of summarize the teacher, but it was not practiced in ancient Israel. A person's views were conveyed in his own words. In other words, you said exactly what your teacher said. Authentic statements contain the authority and power of the one who uttered them, so you dare not change them. And just lastly on this, in the colleges of the rabbis, the little ancient unis, no attempt was made to give a synopsis of the views of the old masters. Their words were quoted together with the name of the one who had uttered them. An ancient rule for the rabbi's pupils was formulated in this way: it is a man's duty to state a teaching in his teacher's own words. They didn't change it, they didn't store it, they didn't give their own interpretation at all. So there, folks, is some of the reasons why I'm very confident that our translations have been transmitted through the centuries, and we can have great confidence that this is really what the apostles said, this is really what Jesus said, this is really what Jesus did, because of all those things that I've talked about. I think it's question time, if we've got time.
Let's do some questions. Regulars know the way we do this. We take a couple of minutes around our tables to try out a question, to formulate what it may be. And then I'm going to bring some slips of paper down. We're not going to play Chinese whispers with our questions. Bring them up to Ben, and Ben will give them an answer. I guess questions, particularly on the transmission of stuff we've been thinking about this evening, would be great. But if you've got wider questions on why we can trust the Bible, throw them in as well. And if there's time, we'll get to them. So a few minutes around your tables to chew these things over, and then we'll get Ben back up to answer your questions. Right, let me cut across your conversations. Have I got everything? I think I've got all the questions that were written down. Great, some good questions here. We might not get through all of them. Some are tied to what Ben was saying, and some are a bit broader in terms of the Bible, so we might get to your ones at the end, but if we don't get to them, maybe you could grab Ben over a coffee or something. Ben, it's very mean for me not to show you these to you but before I ask them, but there we go.
Okay.
Let's put you on the spot. So, question one. We can be confident that the originals have been transmitted accurately, persuaded of that, but how do we know that the originals weren't deliberately made distorted? How do we know that the apostles weren't making it up? Thank you. how do we know that they're not making it up, and then the made up version is being transmitted?
There's a whole other talk there, but everything that they say in regards to Jesus seems to match history. So when they talk about Capernaum, and it says that this particular miracle happened in the synagogue, not a synagogue, it immediately tells historians that there's one synagogue in Capernaum. You can go to Capernaum today, and we've largely dug up what Capernaum looks like, and sure enough, there's only one. They haven't found dozens of synagogues. They found one. When they give times of day or dates and everything, it all kind of matches up. There's a few headaches for Christians in some small areas, but 99% of it all adds up. Furthermore, when the Gospels and Paul's letters began circulating, they were circulated within the generation. So anyone who doubted or had their questions could go and basically still seek out the people that were still alive. Given that they were circulated within 30 years, you could then go, oh, Jesus healed a leper in this town. I don't live very far. I can go and ask and find out. And when Jesus heals in a synagogue, that meant that the whole town was, it was a Saturday, no businesses were open. There were lots of witnesses. So you could easily go and verify it. And the fact that the Gospels then were written within the generation that saw the events and still were sustaining themselves, in a sense, then that gives a lot of credibility.
So if it was all made up, they'd never have got out the starting blocks.
Exactly. Well,
okay.
Put.
Great. So thinking more about the Gospels, and you were saying the Gospel writers were sort of editors of the material they heard.
Yes.
And this question asks, how did they decide what to put in?
Depends who they were writing to. And we do this all the time. If you're going to write an email to your boss or you're going to write an email to your mother-in-law, it's going to kind of read slightly differently, right?
You'd hope so, wouldn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, you'd hope so. or your football mates or whatever. So who you're writing to mattered. Matthew and John seem to be writing very much to Jewish Christians, Jews who became Christians. They use a lot of Jewish terminology. They quote the scriptures, the Old Testament, that is, consistently throughout their Gospels. Mark and Luke seem to be writing to a more Gentile audience, and so they decide, I'm going to put this story in, but this one might be a bit too confusing for the audience, so I'm going to do it this way, but I'm also going to word it slightly this way. So without changing the content or what Jesus said, which they dare not do, they just might include some things that they heard in the tradition and just include that. Or word their own narration in between the pericopes to, you know, just help their audience along a bit. So Mark, when he's using times, when he's talking about the times of the day, he uses the way the Romans divided up the day into four, where Jews divided up the day into thirds. Mm-hmm. And so you see that sort of coming out. Luke is a doctor, a physician. And when one of the other gospel writers tells the story of the woman who is suffering from bleeding for 12 years, one of the other gospel writers said she suffered at the hands of doctors. Luke doesn't include that. As a doctor. There's little things like that that go on. They're writing for different reasons, different purposes, and
thanks, Ben. Similar question. Much of what the New Testament describes is so out of the ordinary.
Yes.
So wouldn't we expect more evidence for it than what we've got?
Yeah, it's such a fair question, isn't it? Because what we believe in as Christians, it is really like, let's be honest, it's strange. It's weird. You know, a guy walking on water or raising others from the dead or calming a storm, being raised from the dead himself. It's all a bit weird. And look, none of us can ultimately prove it. But actually, the way it's written, and I think N.T. Wright, Tom Wright is very good on this, the way it's written, it's almost as though the style of the writing is like, I'm not sure if he uses this term, it's like the ink in their pens is boiling. They're like, I know this sounds strange, I know this sounds weird, but this is what happened. And here are the witnesses, and this is where it happened, and here was the emperor of the time, or here was the governor of the time, and I know it sounds weird, that's why everyone was amazed, that's why everyone was startled, and so there's this language of, I know it sounds weird, and you get that in Luke's opening sentence in verses 1 to 4 of chapter 1 of his gospel. And he's writing to a mate, Theophilus, and he says, look, I know it's weird, I know it's strange, but I've done my research carefully and I've interviewed not second-class ear witnesses but first-class eyewitnesses, and I know it sounds strange, Theophilus, the guy he's writing to, but this is true, and I've written everything in an orderly way to give you great certainty that this really did happen.
Great. Thanks, Ben. There are lots of questions, but we'll do one more, because otherwise we'll be here all night. And to prove that democracy rules, so the two of you asked this question. Here you go.
As in to you and me?
No. As in two people asked the same question.
Oh, I see.
It's basically a question about who decides what is in the Bible. Who decided which books made the cut?
Hmm. Well, ultimately God. Church councils over the years basically signed off on what was already the agreement. So various church councils, groups of elders, bishops, and so on over the centuries basically signed off on what was there. But there was just a general consensus that these books were written by apostles and these ones weren't. So it actually all came down to two things. It's quite complicated, but if you can remember these two things about the canonization of the Bible, that is how the canon, the rule, came about. These two things. Number one, who wrote it? The author. And number two, the content. Did this come from an apostle or someone who sat under an apostle? Yes, this came from Matthew, this came from John, this came from Peter. Mark's gospel gets in because Mark wrote under Peter. So we can trace it to an apostle. Or if they're not entirely sure, is the content what everyone agreed on? Yes, this lines up with what everyone's teaching. It lines up with what the apostles taught. It lines up with everything else that we know was definitely written by an apostle. And that's, incidentally, I think one question was, who wrote the book of Hebrews? We don't know exactly. Some people even say a woman wrote it. That's one theory. We don't know. Some people think Paul. I don't think that. But it certainly gets in on the content. It lines up completely with the rest of the New Testament. It's not saying something in contradiction to it. You've heard of the Gospel of Thomas, of the Gospel of Philip, of the Gospel of Mary, the Nag Hammadi documents. They were written not by apostles, even though it says the Gospel of Philip or the Gospel. They're pseudonyms. They were written over a century later, and the content is radically different to the New Testament. It says Jesus did this and did that and said this, and it actually contradicts what he said. So they were disqualified by the early church, not as a big cover-up, not as a conspiracy theory, but because of the content and who wrote them. So just think author and content, and that's how it gets in. But it doesn't boil down to just one council. The councils were just signing off on what everyone already pretty much agreed on.
Yeah. Great. Ben, thank you so much for coming. Thank you for answering those questions. If we didn't get yours, do grab Ben afterwards. I'm sure he'd be happy to chat a bit more. But, Ben, I'm going to...
Or email.
Ping him an email, and he'll get back to you on that.